Hi, my name is Matt. I'm the founder of Regeneration Projects, a small business that sees two great bays and a river as our most important business partners. We started at a kitchen table during Melbourne's epic COVID-19 lockdown, and now we're a B Corp and actor in the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. As we begin this episode, we'd like to acknowledge the two great bays, Port Phillip and Western Port, which are known to First Peoples as Nam and Wurrumbirrin, or Murrumbik. Without the bays and the Birrarung Yarra River, we wouldn't be in business today. So we show deep respect to First Nations elders, past and present, who for over 60,000 years have cared for the bays, Birrarung, and their catchment areas. Their ecological knowledge inspires us to practice business in partnership with nature. Now, choosing a career that tackles environmental issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, or pollution can be incredibly rewarding, but also super tough. When we listen to the stories of passionate and pioneering professionals, it stokes our inner fire and belief so that we can keep doing the work that we know needs to be done to benefit future generations. That's what the Two Bays podcast is all about. Stories of hope, grit, and determination, inspiring the planet's next generation of ecological leaders and entrepreneurs. This series is made in partnership with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and celebrates the stories of business and community champions at the forefront of local climate action. Let's tune in. Wamajika, welcome and come with purpose to the Two Bays podcast. My name's Matt Sykes, and this particular episode I'm flying solo without Claire, but joined by two amazing leaders down on the Mornington Peninsula. As you know, this series is all about spotlighting climate champions that are taking action through their day-to-day business and being able to share those stories as a way of inspiring the next wave of climate action. As always, we'll take a moment to ground ourselves and to connect with country, those beautiful two bays, Nam Port Phillip or Western Port, also known as Murrumbik or Wurrumbirrin, those connections to the Boonwurrung and Bunurong communities. Today, we're going to be talking about food and wine, two very familiar and favourite topics of mine, having grown up in a family where we love both of those things. But today, we're going to be putting a bit of a twist on something that seems so familiar, focusing in climate. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us on the Two Bays podcast. Melissa, as the founder and owner of Red Gum Barbecue up at Red Hill there, and also Taryn from the Higginbotham Estate, who's also founder and one of the founders and owners there. So, Melissa, I'm going to come straight to you and curious, what do you see the connection between climate change, climate action, and life and work on the Mornington Peninsula being?
Sure, thanks. And thanks, Matt. And looking forward to chatting with you, Taryn, as well. What an awesome topic, food and wine, and then climate and how we can sort of do better by our planet and our community. We are blessed to live on the Mornington Peninsula, where we are immersed in nature, surrounded by the bays and the beautiful hinterlands and all of our sort of precious wildlife. And I think we have such a unique opportunity, being that it is a really small community, relatively, to kind of be united with purpose and to create impact where we can see those direct results of that really immediately and, you know, broadly. So I think I get really excited when I think about, obviously, we're connected to nature, we're connected to all of these incredible environments around us, and to think that as a Mornington Peninsula, we could decide to do things differently and really sort of create this microcosm of wonder and a new and better way.
Thank you, Melissa. And Taryn, you're actually right in the middle of harvest at the moment, and you've stepped in to be able to join us on the podcast. So thank you for creating that space and time. So, I mean, right now at the moment, what are you noticing some of these links between what's going on, the climate, the season, and your harvest season at Higginbotham Estate?
The harvest this year is probably a little bit earlier, and it has been over the last few years. We've started a little bit earlier. That's partly to do with having some extremely warm days, and you get a few in a row, and that pushes things along quite significantly. The reason we chose Mornington Peninsula was because of the cool climate, and for creating premium wine, cool climate grapes give you the elegance and that full flavour. And so that's really why we chose to be here first and foremost. It's an hour from Melbourne, so you still got everything that Melbourne has to offer. But you are, as Melissa said, you're surrounded by these wonderful landscapes, rural, natural bushland, fantastic beaches. What better place to grow up and pick grapes? So it was pretty nice out there this morning, but it's getting a bit hot now, so this was quite a nice reprieve.
we'll keep you with us for as long as we can.
Thank you.
Taryn, just sticking with you for a moment, can you share a little bit more about the story of Higginbotham and how it emerged, what sparked the interest with wine? And you mentioned there that relationship between the place and you know, actually having that business of creating wine. How did it all come to be?
Andrew's family, the Higginbotham family, has been in the wine game for back to Andrew's grandfather, and he was the first wine chemist at Roseworthy in South Australia. So he helped develop discovered that pH was crucially important in the creation of wine. And so it was a family tradition, I suppose, and we've just followed along. And while he was still alive, Andrew's father, we did some testing of fruit and making wine from various regions around Victoria and even Tasmania. And Mornington Peninsula every time came up trumps, like the fruit quality, disease, you know, even though there's a lot of disease pressure down here, the fruit was always outstanding quality, and it every time made fantastic Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So in 1988, Andrew and I found this property that we're on now and purchased that. So just a nice open woodland with some remnant bushland, which we keep as land for wildlife. And there was some magnificent older trees, mana gums, throughout the property. And the cleared areas, which were cow paddocks or bull paddocks, we turned those into vineyard areas. So we didn't have to actually remove any trees to put the vineyards in. So we've kept as much natural bushland as we possibly can on the property, and then started planting more trees to maintain that nice rural outlook.
Yeah, sensational. I'm really looking forward to being able to hear a little bit more about that holistic land management approach that you've, you know, you're working with down there. Melissa, coming across to you, Red Gum Barbecue, just short walk, short ride, short drive away from Higginbotham Estate. Red Gum Barbecue is also a B Corp, like Regeneration Project, so there's a certain element in the DNA of the way that you operate that has that social and environmental impact in that specific model. But, yeah, tell us a little bit more about how Red Gum Barbecue came to be, and I guess how this relationship between climate and the purpose of your work manifests in day-to-day life.
Sure, thanks. And we have a much shorter history on the peninsula and, you know, all together than Taryn and her story. We started chatting in about 2013 when we got really serious about what we might do next with our lives and careers. I was a school teacher and my husband worked for local government in youth projects and passion. Food was always a passion of ours. He turned around one day when our son was just a baby, and he was spending a lot of time watching Man v Food on television during Pat leave, and said, "I'd like to open a barbecue restaurant," which was not as far-fetched as it sounds from our earlier conversations. But we had lots of really intense conversations about what going into business for ourselves would be like, and what were some of those expectations that we wanted to set of ourselves. I think, wanting to build a business that we were going to be proud of, that we could share with our children with one day, coming from professions that we felt were quite altruistic in nature and made us, have the feel goods about what we did for the world, into sort of private commercial enterprise was daunting. And we sort of made some of those commitments very early on that money and profits were not the priority for us, but the priority was the thing that we were creating and the way that we were doing it, and wanting to build something that we were really proud of and that we enjoyed and that put something into the world rather than just taking it. So we made some early commitments to sourcing free range and grass-fed products because that felt like a real tension for us early on, being animal lovers and knowing a little bit about the factory farming scene. We really struggled with that. It continues to be a difficult thing to do. There's, I think, even when I looked at the statistic again recently, there's something like 3% of Australia's pork sales are free range. So we still have a lot of our meat products going through really damaging processes for both the animals and the environment. We just, sort of grew in that purpose. It really started with just wanting to kind of be proud of the things that we were doing and how we were doing them. And that was a theme very early on into all of our conversations, where we were questioning which suppliers to use, what wines to purchase, what beers to purchase. We source only local Mornington Peninsula wines. We work with only craft brewers local. So we've sort of made these commitments to the community and feeling really passionately about the business being born here, our family growing up here, and how we can, our dollars have impact and they can give back to the community and go into local families and local jobs. So yeah, we've just sort of continued to kind of bring those questions into our practices at every point and challenge one another on not making the easy choice, but the choice that really aligned with our values. And then B Corp came around in, I guess, 2017. We started learning about B Corp and going down that path, and got our certification in 2018, which was, just this kind of whole new world of being able to have a blueprint for what we're doing and why we're doing it, and to kind of learn from and embed and grow. So that's been amazing.
Wowee. All righty. So I can smell the smoke of a barbecue in the background. I've got a glass of wine in my hand. We're now going to start diving deeper into this world of climate. And there was something that you shared there, Melissa. I'm going to pass back to Terranon. But both of you, the way you were communicating, there was this element of the way you're doing business, the way that you're living, and your way you're bringing up family, and the way you're making decisions. It's part of a whole system. I think it's interesting because so often when we hear about, climate or circular economy or, biodiversity types of things, we hear about it in quite an isolated sense. But the way it shows up in both your stories and the other champions that we're listening to is that it's just part of the way that you work. So, Taryn, on the property, when you're making decisions, and in particular when you started to think about this climate journey and becoming more active in that space, What did the decision process look like? Was it out when you're out in the vineyard? Was it sitting around the table after a long day? Was it, you know, on the veranda and you're having a conversation? Was it something that you, a conversation that you had with your children? Like, what was the spark and what got you going? What are a couple of examples of things that you've got involved in that climate space?
Well, I think we started so long ago that we were quite young ourselves, so it was before children. So we did a lot of sitting around with a glass of wine and chatting about things. But Andrew had always been a collector of old things. So that was part of our whole starting out point, that we got an option to dismantle the old Hampton High School Hall Gymnasium, and that became our winery. So that was when Jeff Kennett was selling off schools to, you know, balance the books, I suppose. So we converted that into a really fantastic winery space, because it's a big A-frame building, and so you can load barrels up high and have big tanks in it and that sort of thing. So all of our building is made from recycled, reclaimed things that have had a previous life. So that was probably our first foray into doing that. And then we had the joy of having David Bellamy come and speak at our winery as part of a sustainability type thing when the Shire decided they were wanting to go down a sustainability path. And he said, you know, everything just one little thing at a time, start in your own backyard. So that's been our philosophy since then. Every little thing that we can do to make things better is one step forward. And I think that's, you know, just how a lot of people start. I know people that just go down every morning to the beach and take a plastic bag and fill up all the crap they find on the beach on their walk, and, you know, every little thing helps. And our business has grown like that. We've tried using recycled bottles until that was closed down because it was deemed unhygienic. But in Europe, they reuse the same Grosch bottles over and over and over again. So it is something we could be doing, but we don't seem to have the initiative in government to allow those sort of things to happen. We have sheep go through our paddocks to, like, when we finish picking the grapes, we let the sheep graze in the paddock. So that's a low impact, you know, keep the grass down, fertilize the soil naturally, and we can then use those sheep through our restaurant as well. So a very small circle there. The only problem is there's no abattoirs on the Mornington Peninsula. So you have to drive your sheep to Warragul to have them, you know, euthanized, and then bring them back to the butcher to dress them and put them through legally through your restaurant. So there's all those sort of things that could be better, but there's, you know, there's quite a lot of red tape with a lot of these things too. And I'm sure Melissa's found that as well. You know, there's some things just aren't easy to do in the most efficient manner that you could possibly do. There's a lot of red tape stopping you from just going from A to B. You've got to go A via E to D to C to, you know, back again. So there's all of that. But we do the best we can. Yep.
And not just efficient as well, like the most progressive, right? So I think that's that sort of barrier as well, is like there's not the forward thinking to go, hey, that's a great idea. Like, that doesn't fit within our sort of current rules, but we love it. It's got the spirit of what we want to achieve.
Correct.
So go and do that. I think there's a lot of that too.
Yep, definitely. I mean, the Shire likes to think they're sustainable, but there's, you know, certain things they're fantastic on, but some things, you know, there's a lot of red tape.
It sounds like we're in a bit of a state of transition at the moment, and there is a theme around this that's coming up where there's certain old ways that are, you know, we're maybe trying to reintroduce or remember or reinterpret. Just as you were talking about the sheep there, I actually grew up in Warragul, so and had, you know, sheep as a family as well. But you know, while I have memories of my dad sending me off, you know, out of sight when I was a kid, and then the bleat of a sheep behind, and then being able to get a little science class introduction on the inner workings of a sheep. But you know, that realness, that connection, or whether it was the birthing of lambs, or the, you know, or sometimes even bottle feeding those lambs, those connections and that closeness with those ways are probably more distant now. And it's probably where in some of our systems that's reflected in our policy environments. And this is, you know, it's that whole thing of like, do kids know where their milk's coming from? But here we're talking about, you know, wine or other aspects of food. Melissa, in your decision-making processes at Redgum, you know, what does it look like when you sit down, and is there an example of when you and your partner set off on doing a specific initiative? What did that decision-making process look like? Was it like, hey, I've got this idea, like, what about this? Or did it kind of come from a third party? But yeah, is there an example of how that played out with a specific initiative you've embarked on in that climate space?
I think I can speak to what we came up with last year. Was it last year? Gosh, well, what year are we in? Okay, so not last year, but the year before. So I think we put a name to it in probably, where are we, 2024, 2022, which was what we're calling our meaty impacts. And I'm not sure how far back you wanted me to go, but is recent history, yep. So our meaty impact was the name that we were going to give all of the work that we were doing in this space, and try and, you know, be more specific in naming it and putting it up on our website and being visible and accountable and measuring. So, you know, yeah, there's been like what Taryn was talking about, which are the little steps, and the little steps continue to happen. I think everybody is doing their parts, whether they've got names to them or not. But yeah, in 2022, we said we want to really formalize this stuff beyond B Corp. We want to be talking about what we as a business are doing and all of the ways that we're doing it. So that was about, you know, for us to be tracking to these things, for us to have accountability to ourselves and to our words, and to, you know, I guess, cut through a little bit of some of the noise that you hear in this space that I think can be really distracting and also good. So, you know, I like to think that like everybody who's saying they're doing something, whether they are or they aren't, actually is fine, because it's setting an expectation at the very sort of at the entry level that like that we're all doing these things. So then that next level is like, well, how are you doing it, and being accountable to that. So that's where we are. Our media impact is, it's measuring like how much money we're giving to like local community programs or initiatives, to how much waste we're keeping out of landfill and composting, to, you know, how much sort of like money we're sending into local suppliers, how many volunteer hours our staff are engaging in.
Well, Melissa, something that we also touched on in one of our pre-calls was around your relationship with water at the restaurant. Did you want to dive into that one a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So we have a really old building in Red Hill, and it captures water from the roof and filters down into a well on the property, and then is filtered through the business. So we have we have measures in place like low flow taps and water saving initiatives, and just talk to our staff about the finite resource that that is and how we use it more responsibly.
Terrific. And Taryn, passing back to you, you touched on the relationship between the vineyard and the sheep that you've got on the property. And a bit earlier you were mentioning, you know, some of the, I guess, the bush regeneration that you've been enabling as well. Are there some examples where you've been able to do things that have had a positive environmental and also a climate benefit, but also that are really strong for the commercial aspects of the business as well? Sometimes they're presented as an opposing, you know, conflict, but so often we actually see them as mutually reinforcing. What does that look like in your property?
We actually received a grant for climate change from the Shire, and that enabled us to regenerate some areas of our property, but it also helped us with some blackberry removal and to plant a rather large vegetable garden. So all of that produce is going onto our plates as we speak, pretty much. So that sort of thing has been really a great benefit. People, when they're sitting at the restaurant tasting fresh tomatoes straight off the vine that morning, nothing better, you know, the flavours are just outstanding. That to me has been fantastic. The other thing we have noticed too is a significant increase in bees around with the new native plants in that have more flowering capacity. So we've had a lot of native bee and obviously honeybees as well. So that's been great. They also bring the birds, which is a negative for when you have grapes on the vine. So, because the birds love grapes. So there's a bit of a...
There's a bit of a trade-off here. You might be sharing a few things with a few extra stakeholders in your supply chain, maybe. Just on the bees, because they are super important stakeholders in
on a planetary,
you know, on well, just in nature and food systems. Oh, yeah, do you want to just touch on that? Because you know, increase of bees is really, really important. It's not always the narrative that we're hearing in some places. Can you just explain to you how critical the bee population is in terms of the success of your crop?
A lot of vine flowers can be self-pollinating, but having the bees there just helps that whole process along. You know, if you have more bees, you have more successful pollination throughout the vineyard. And also with the vegetable crop, you know, you need the bees there to fertilise your tomatoes and your zucchinis and all of those sort of things. So, the bees play a vital role in all of that. And then obviously in the native regeneration, unless you get pollination and seed set, you don't have a next generation of those plants back into the environment.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. You know, part of my early career was in landscape architecture, and I was doing some re-veg work on different properties, including on the Mornington Peninsula, actually, but especially down in West Gippsland. And at that time, it seemed to be, let's say, you know, kind of somewhat pioneering work where land care was really taking off and, you know, reclaiming waterways, creek lines, even, you know, the areas around dams and so on for wildlife, and having that as part of the, I guess, the infrastructure, like an ecological kind of infrastructure in the way that a property is designed. And just your mention a little bit earlier of some of the remnant vegetation that you've worked up around. I always remember these big eucalypts that literally were, you know, probably 100 years old, and yet everything had been taken out from around them, and we were creating that space to fence them off, allow that natural recruitment of seeds in the soil to be able to come up, but also add those other layers. And it's something perhaps on the peninsula where the green wedge comparatively is a strong presence, but still the importance of habitat connectivity. I'm wondering, how does your property relate to other properties around you as part of that way that the bees, the birds and other wildlife get around? Is that part of your property planning as well?
Yes, but our property is fairly isolated. Our land for wildlife adjoins Nepean Highway, which is a fairly high traffic area, which is not conducive to wildlife movement so much. But Wallace's Road, which our property adjoins also, so we're on a triangle block, is a dirt road and has natural vegetation all the way up the road. And there are some lovely bushland areas up through there. So it's a corridor. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of degradation on the major roads of the natural corridors in vegetation. And I think that, you know, if I had anything to ask the council would be to have those maintained a little bit and replanted with the indigenous vegetation back to the way they should be. But they don't like the fire risk of having vegetation.
It's a challenge, that one, that fire conversation, and you know, having done some work with First Nations communities as well, where, you know, that traditional practice of burning country is as part of the seasonal cycle, but these days where we've got more infrastructure and different things in place, it can be a challenging thing. But it's still the power of fire, also to wake places up, is really powerful. Melissa, speaking of power, thinking of winds that have had positive environmental outcomes and business outcomes at Red Gum, are there a couple of moments that come to mind? Like, was B Corp one? Were there other things where you've made a decision and you've seen the co-benefits?
Yes, they do. They have all kinds of wins, right? So they have commercial wins, they have feel-good wins, they have brand loyalty. There are lots of ways in which the story that we tell around what we're doing for the community and for the environment and for each other is greater than the sum of that singular part. You know, they're all interconnected, that when we tell the story about how we're doing something for our community, we're sharing that as a guide to how we can all do something like that for our community. We are telling our customers and the community that we're a good business that cares for our community and creates that brand loyalty idea, the connection to us as a business they can attend and feel good. We have people comment all the time, more so lately than probably 5 years ago when we became a B Corp business, 6 years ago now, that they care about that. They see that B Corp sign, they read it on our stuff, and it matters to them. So they're more likely to, you know, patron our business and buy our products. It has been a really wonderful journey of creating relationships and nurturing relationships with fellow like-minded businesses around us to kind of, you know, to grow that like ripple into a wave, to go back to our nature metaphors. Like, there's just a million wins to it. And then there's the, you know, there's the obvious win that, like, there is no alternative. Like, we all have to be doing this. We have to be getting better at doing it. We have to be getting better at communicating about it. Like, you know, climate change and climate disaster are like imminent. And unless we kind of all get stuck into some really big decisions and hard choices, like, there's not going to be another option. So, There's all kinds of good, feel-good reasons for it. There's financial reasons for it. And then there's just like, you can't make another choice reason
yeah,
for
that,
it.
That last one is really powerful. And you've both talked about that influence of intergenerational thinking on the way that you work. Taryn, coming back to you, with you know, you've been inherited this story across generations, and now looking ahead, no doubt, you know, you've got family that are connected to the property there in some way, and you know, looking ahead at the coming decades or generations, what are some of the things that run through your mind, and what do you hope to see for the future, particularly in relation to, you know, the health of the environment on the peninsula and the way that benefits the community as a whole?
I think following COVID, I think people finally remembered how important nature was to them when they were locked up in a house and, you know, could walk, you know, 5 kilometres, that was your radius. I think that for all those people that weren't anywhere near a beach or a really lovely park, I felt for all of those people. We could get out onto our property and just go, oh, aren't we lucky here? It was lucky in one way, but we couldn't go anywhere else either. So, you know, our 5K went to Dramana. So, so all of that, I think that reminding people how important that putting your feet in the sand or on the earth is to your well-being. And I think that's something our kids do a lot more. They're not quite as busy as us still in the business, but they've also picked up our passion for reusing and reclaiming things. They're on marketplace every second day buying stuff to, you know, refresh their homes, and I think all that sort of thing. It's so good to see that in young people, that they have picked up that passion, and they do, you know, you're sort of restricted in what you can do during your life, but every little thing helps. So I think that's a good start for our kids. You know, I think also we're going to have to get them involved in telling the story too, because I think that's an important part, which is something we probably never did well enough. But with social media these days, you can tell that story so easily and get it out to a lot of people. And I think that's where Red Gum Barbecue's done that brilliantly. All of their stories are about how they have achieved what they have done. And we probably need to cycle back a little bit and start telling the story from our inception as well, to get people to understand where we've come from and how we progress too. So I think, yeah, that's up to our kids now.
All right. Sounds like you're already starting with this podcast recording there, Taryn. But, yeah, a shout-out to Red Gum Barbecue for that work. Melissa, when you do think about that, almost that intergenerational narrative of business and the way it will evolve on the peninsula, what do you feel is important to pass on?
Gosh, I'm trying to think of my kids who are now 12 and 9, and I just don't know that they need any guidance from us. Like they're learning it like in a way that we never did, right? So they've got it, like, and I just feel like there's an awareness sitting with them that I'm so thankful for, that is, you know, gonna be not another reality. Like I think about some of the things that we did growing up in terms of the way that we, you know, as myself as an individual in my family, how we managed our rubbish, how we thought of our natural resources. And like, it's mind blowing to me now that wasn't just sort of like common knowledge, that what are we doing? And you know, some people knew, they kept it very purposefully from us. But yeah, our kids know. I think my kids in particular, like, and our children here, like, they're growing up in this place with this very healthy appreciation for nature. You know, I drive across the peninsula between Mount Eliza and Red Hill daily, and my kids are in school in Tyab, and they, you know, play sport everywhere. And I'm like, look at the cows. Oh my God, like everywhere, you know, look at this sunset and look at the view of the water. And we stop and appreciate it constantly, whether we're sort of purposely in it, walking or hiking or at the beach, or whether we're sort of just noticing it on our daily movements. But I can't imagine that they're not gonna to just be in the world in a much better way than we are. So, you know, I guess the more we can sort of pass down, I guess, ways that we think they can do things, the better. But they're quite a few steps ahead of us.
It sounds like there's an element there of, yeah, giving them that free rein to run ahead and, you know, to really support them. But it is encouraging, and we'll actually be connecting with some of the local schools to hear how they are learning about climate and environment as part of their day-to-day education, because it, you know, it's a big part of where it starts, of course, with family too.
Yeah. Sorry, just on that, Matt, like, I'm just thinking, we were at the beach like 2 weeks ago with my kids, and they disappeared wandering around and came back half an hour later with bags of rubbish they'd collected, you know, like, without, nobody said anything to them. Nobody said, go find, but they were like, this is disgusting. And I was like, I agree. So yeah, it's heartening to see the way that they view the world and the planet and everything around them in ways that we just, for the most part, I can only speak for myself, didn't when I was their age.
Oh, sensational. So if maybe if I can, I'll come back to you, Melissa, on that note. If you think about your own, you know, story and journey from a personal perspective, and you take yourself down to that favorite beach, and, you know, you're on that favorite beach, maybe you've got a glass of wine in your hand, maybe you're in bare feet, but you're kind of connecting with your past self for a moment. What advice would you give your past self, and perhaps even others on the Mornington Peninsula that might be thinking about starting their own, you know, climate journey or, you know, environmental journey with business as a vehicle for that? What's just one pearl of wisdom that you would have shared to your former self or that person?
Gosh, I love these questions of like, what would you tell your earlier self? Because all I can think immediately is just like, be kind to yourself, right? Like, because we say awful things to ourselves when we're the only ones that can hear it. But I think if I were going to speak to me or somebody else, it would be that small, start small, you know, whatever it is that you can do in the smallest way. I think we sometimes don't go on journeys where the journey feels too big, or the outcome or the end feels too hard. I would just sort of say, you know, find a thing that you want to do and just do it. I guess I'll throw two other things in here. One is, don't let anybody tell you what it has to be like. You know, don't let somebody else define the rules. If you want to go ahead and do it in a certain way, there's going to be a lot of people around that can tell you it should be done a different way. And, you know, I think that the greatest things happen when we eschew the rules and forge our own path. And I guess the last point has just left my brain entirely, but come back to me. It was my big idea, and it's gone now.
You got to watch out for those big ideas. Sometimes you have to wrangle them a little bit. Taryn, passing across to you. If you are walking along a beach, glass of wine in your hand, bare feet, maybe a smell of barbecue in the background, what's the little bit of advice that you'd give to your past self?
Probably allow myself more time to walk on the beach would be my number one priority. But apart from that, give yourself the time to enjoy what you've made, and to enjoy the positives and reflect on the negatives. And, you know, doing these things can be bloody hard work. And as Melissa was saying, you know, sometimes people are saying, oh, you can't do that. You know, that's not the right way to do things. But, yeah, you've just got to allow yourself the benefit of the doubt and just go, I don't care, we're just going to do this anyway and we'll see what comes at the end. So, yeah, push your own barrel a little bit, I suppose, and do things the way that makes sense to you. And every little bit helps. I suppose that's, you know, and yes, be kind to yourself as well, which I suppose comes back to spending more time on the beach with the glass of wine.
Yeah, brilliant. Taryn, Melissa, thank you so much for joining us on the Two Bays podcast today. I think that both of those pearls of wisdom and that sentiment of giving ourselves a bit of a pat on the back. I know that many of us that work in business with it, that have that awareness of what's going on in terms of climate change or biodiversity loss or pollution, these pressures are something that we often personally carry, and it often means that we tend to do something and then look at the next thing and then look at the next thing and look at the next thing without pausing for, you know, that glass of wine or that walk on the beach, or dare I say both. It's a big one. Just a story that comes up as you share that. A colleague in Tasmania talked about whenever they had a win, they would bake a cake and they would eat the cake as a team, and that win might have been like a little tiny thing, but they still baked a cake, and that culture of reward gave them I guess the power to keep on moving on. And I think it's a great lesson for all of us working in this space. So Melissa, I think you might have wrangled that big idea. Go for it.
I had. And I think it just, you know, when I think about the times when I felt frustrated, or, you know, what you're talking about for, I think about, like, you know, putting your head above the parapet, whether you're talking about how you're doing something, or, you know, like, there's always an opportunity for somebody to kind of create that accountability on social media or not. Like, Taryn, those are the dangers of that, right? And I think that whether it's self-doubt or it's others' doubt on you, you know, there's always an opportunity to kind of think you can be doing more, you're not doing it well enough, you're not doing it right, or and I think the thing that I would tell somebody that wants to kind of start this journey is just to kind of to think about what it is their sort of main purpose, like, what is that value that's driving them, and to just hold as tightly as they can to that, and to kind of look inward and connect to that as often and as frequently as they can, because the noise will always be there, whether it's in your own head or outside of it. And if you can feel good about that, you know, feel good about why you're doing things, what you're doing them for, you know, then who cares whether or not you're sort of saving the planet or you're, you know, putting less rubbish into landfill. It's just, you know, what you can to the extent that you can, and feeling connected to why you're there is most important.
Wise words as we wrap up this episode. Alrighty, Melissa and Taryn, thank you so much for the work that you're doing at Red Gum Barbecue and Higginbotham Estate. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Two Bays podcast. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you soon. How amazing are those Mornington Peninsula climate champions? Must be something in the water. Against the odds, they're transforming climate anxiety into climate action. Keep your eyes out New episodes coming soon. So you're feeling inspired and ready to act. What can you do next? Firstly, subscribe to the Two Bays podcast on your favorite channel. Then visit the Regeneration Project's website for more info about our ecological leadership and strategic consultancy work. Lastly, don't forget to follow Regeneration Projects on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as subscribe to our seasonal newsletter. My name is Matt, and on behalf of Regeneration Projects and the Two Bays, thank you for tuning in and see you on the next episode of Two Bays, a Business and a Kitchen Table podcast.